present them with a new style, new packaging, a new region, anything new, they sort of shrink back and want nothing to do with it.
This is One on One, a Table for Two production. I am Antoine Aboussamra.
You have to be willing to step outside the box and give things a chance and change your own beliefs. And I think that's just very hard for people to accept. I wanted to do a restaurant, a wine bar, but I wanted to give people an educational experience and take them through the world of wine that I had seen.
In every episode, I invite you to discover the stories of people in the world of food who are on a mission to protect the environment, defend their cultures, or fight for more social and economic justice. One on One will help you redefine your relationship to food.
When I no longer hear the one phrase I hate the most, which is, "Hey, this is actually good." When that phrase changes to, "Hey, this is good," I will have succeeded.
Good evening. It's a great pleasure to be back for a new episode of the podcast. And today I have the honor, privilege, and pleasure to welcome Sarah Trubnik. She's coming to us from New Hampshire in the East Coast of the United States, and she's an expert in the world of wine. I'll let you discover her whole bio in the notes of the podcast and the website. But if you were to introduce yourself in, I'm not going to ask you for your elevator pitch, but if you were to describe yourself in 2 minutes, how would you do that?
Oh, 2 minutes. Okay. I am a wine person. So what that means is I do all things wine. The reason I do all things wine is because wine is a fascinating topic that basically merges history, geology, physics, chemistry, everything all together. And so it's kind of a topic that is endlessly interesting. You can never know enough, right? When you think you do know a lot of lies, you don't think. So I've been involved in wine in all levels of the industry and I'm constantly learning. So I have post-nominals and I have positions and all of that, but I think that's really how I would sum myself up because yes, I'm the wine director of a restaurant. I'm the owner of an import company. I'm the owner of a distribution company, but those are just titles. But I think I would sum myself up as a wine person in all aspects.
Very humble. There was something when we were talking and preparing for the podcast that struck me is that you are a wine person. But there's an ulterior motive as well, because you are seeing things happening in the world around you and you want to try to find solution for that. It's like you want to be able to instill some change in the industry, because there's a lot of things, you know, it's something we've talked about on the podcast and on different shows that I've been doing about changing the industry and how the industry is evolving as well. And you're taking part in that. And it seems that it's very important for you to bring change within the industry. What was the initial idea you had when you came into the world of wine? And then once you started working into the world of wine, the realization that maybe it was a bit different than what your perception was?
So my background before I got involved in wine is engineering and physics. So I have a degree in electrical engineering and I have a master's degree in applied physics. And I was trained to solve problems. That's what I did. You know, a broken system, whether it's a physical system or whether it's a theoretical system, it can be broken. And so you bring in the engineers. Mm-hmm. And I think when I started in wine, my goal was to discover the world of wine. I found it fascinating. And when I first started, my goal was to basically make a restaurant. Now, people said, "Oh, but you're not using your degree." And yes, I am. A restaurant is full of problems to solve.
All the time.
It is constantly broken at all times. There's always something that is definitely not working right. And there's no solution that's in a book. So you can read books, you can get degrees on hospitality management. And, you know, they talk about restaurant. And then you put yourself in the restaurant and yeah, none of it applies.
You went into the world of wine and you started a restaurant. I would have thought maybe why not a winery?
You know, I mean, that's That's an interesting question, but I did vintage work. So I worked in Bordeaux and in Umbria and in Australia. And when I came home, I hadn't seen my family for a long time, and my family had relocated to San Francisco. So I had been gone for a year and a half. So I wanted to spend time with my family. And I think that made it so that I looked into hospitality. Also, I was familiar with restaurants because, as a good college student, of course, I worked in restaurants. So it was something familiar enough. Whereas a winery, I would need a lot of capital. And I did not have that. And also, though I had worked harvests and worked in the cellars, I would not be comfortable trying to make wine or grow grapes at that point. So the restaurant was an easier way to get into the industry. I guess that's a strange thing to say. A restaurant is not easy at
No,
all.
it's not.
But also, I think I wanted to share the knowledge that I had gained from traveling, from discovering regions. Now, this was, 15 years ago. So now some of the regions that people, they would laugh when I would say, oh, there's great wine there. Now they're well established and people expect good wine from there. But 15 years ago, there were regions that I had encountered on my travels that just weren't represented. And so I wanted to do a restaurant, a wine bar, but I wanted to give people an educational experience and take them through the world of wine that I had seen. So doing things like wine flights, where you give them a familiar wine, but then give them two that aren't familiar, and they're excited to try it because it's a flight and people love flights, but you're forcing them out of their comfort zone, making them try a wine from Serbia, a wine from, a strange region in Croatia or something like that, where maybe they wouldn't have gone for that region or that style. And so I think education was always part of it. I was going to educate one way or another. I can't help it. I mean, I worked as a tutor all through college, all through grad school, and educated people about physics, which people think is hard, but it's not. You just have to have a good teacher. And I think wine is similar, where everyone assumes it's very complicated. I mean, it is, but they assume it's so complicated and only experts can understand it. But of course, that's not true. You just need to have a good teacher. So I think I wanted my wine bar to be that good teacher.
And they had you were teaching the people. And how was the response from your customers when you started showing them new things that they were not aware of or never heard of? Because at the beginning, you're in San Francisco, Napa is next door. Probably the things you're accustomed to are just next door. But when you start to go into the wider world, especially of places that you've never heard of, what was the initial reaction?
As AD physics and engineering, I think I need problems to solve, or else I'm not happy. I could have easily gone into the industry working as a sommelier in a steakhouse, and poured Napa wines, and that's it. But that's not, nothing against those wines. I mean, they're great, but that's not my area of interest. So I fully expected an uphill battle, and it seems like that's a theme with what I do. I always seek out the uphill battle, but
By default.
it's just who I am. I can't help it. So I feel like people were interested, they were intrigued. We will always operate on the fringes, I think. Whatever business I do, it's always a fringe business because I don't feel that the regions, the wine styles, whatever, that already have a spotlight, they don't need help. And so I think people who were interested in that kind of stuff found a home at our wine bar, which then became a restaurant and now is a big restaurant in the financial district. But yeah, so we ended up with a very devoted group of people who would come in all the time to see what we were pouring. And we still have those people. So I think it's well received, but well received by a subset of the community.
Are you able to pinpoint what the profile of these people would be like?
No, it's all over the place. It's just people who want to see something different. So we've had young people, we've had people in their 70s who come in every single time we change our menu because they want to taste the new wines. We've had people who come in for conferences every year and book events or book a large table because that's their excuse, but they always come to us because they want to drink new wines and bring other people and have them experience it. So it's all across the board. It's just curious people, I think. That's our demographic.
Because it's interesting, because now you're based in New Hampshire, so you're on the other side, on the other coast. And there, one of your problem solving or the uphill battle that you put yourself into is to try to get people to change their perception as consumers of the wines that are produced locally or, you know, in the vicinity versus always getting things from, let's say, from Napa or Washington or et cetera. And so your work is to be able to change their habits, make them see that there are other things happening and that they should give it a try. Is that still part of your problem solving objectives that you're doing this?
Yes, I chose to try to distribute wines that are probably the most difficult to distribute, but I don't think they should be. And so, yes, I took on that uphill battle. It's interesting because so San Francisco is much more open-minded in general than New Hampshire. That's a very big blanket statement, but we'll go with it. So there, I can create crazy menus and people are going to love them and want to drink the wine. I mean, I can put wild stuff on the menu and I know people are going to, there's going to be that subset there that says, oh my God, that style that I've been looking for, they have it. I'm going to try it. Here in New Hampshire, different. So, you know, I was thinking about an interesting assignment that I had, and I promise this is related, but I had an ethics class at my university, and I had to take it. And I remember there was an assignment where you had to take a position on an argument, and you had to present to the class and try and convince people that you were correct. And one of the topics was, and you had to take a position one way or the other, is truth absolute or can it be relative? And this really applies to our political situation right now in the
Yes.
US, but we won't go there because I can't stand talking about that. But I, of course, thought, look, I'm a scientist. Like, truth is as absolute as it can possibly be. As a scientist, I'm going to say plus or minus 5%. That's kind
There's
of the
always a
rule.
range, yes.
So, but I would say truth is truth. Maybe I just don't know the truth yet. So, if I have all the facts in front of me and you know, I can say, look, this is true according to what I see in front of me. I can edit that later if I need to, if I discover more information, but truth is absolute. So I decided to take the other side, my uphill battle thing. And I decided to argue that truth was relative. And I thought, now, how am I going to do that? Because one, I don't believe it. And two, what's going to support this? Then what I did was I picked up a dictionary and I looked up the word truth. And I saw a very unsettling definition. One said, you know, what is supported by facts? And then another definition right underneath it was, what is accepted by most people as true? And it didn't say true, it said something else. But
As valid.
I thought that was really interesting that that is a definition of truth. It was like, and that also applies to our political system now. What is, you know, what a bunch of people say is true can be defined as true. It's very unsettling. But I think
And the
about that a
louder you
lot,
scream it, sometimes the louder you scream
the
it,
more true it
the
gets,
truer
right? Yeah.
it gets. That's what that's what they think. Yeah, but that's one of the way
Exactly.
they achieve their objectives.
And it's even, you know, this was over a decade ago and it was in the dictionary. And I think about that when I'm dealing with the New Hampshire wine industry. There are wonderful people here who are very open-minded, but the majority of them are not. If you present them with a new style, new packaging, a new region, anything new, they sort of shrink back and want nothing to do with it. And the reason is I had a woman, name names, but I had a woman refuse to taste a particular type of wine. She would not taste it. Based on where it was from. And I said, are you sure you wouldn't like to taste it? And she said, no, I won't taste that.
Where was it from? Just by curiosity.
Yes, and it was from here. It was from New Hampshire.
A local thing.
Yeah. So that astounded me because you're forming an opinion, but you could maybe support your opinion. Maybe you would taste it and say, this is terrible, and now I've supported my opinion. Or maybe you would discover something new. But the truth of the matter was what everyone says it was, which is New Hampshire makes bad wine. That's the truth, because so
Okay.
many people say it. So unfortunately, I have to, try and combat definition number two with definition number one of truth and present the facts and hope people will listen. And maybe I can make more people support my view of New Hampshire wine, for example. And if they're loud enough, maybe that will become truth. But we'll see.
What is very interesting is that for them to get that idea, that point of view, of saying, okay, New Hampshire wines are not good. Something must have happened before in terms of what they heard, what they listened, what they were, taught, what people they were trusting told them about, only good wines come from France or from Napa or from Italy or whatever it is. And they form that opinion and they get to a point where they don't want to even try something new because why? Would it make them reconsider what they think is right? Is that an ego
It
thing?
would challenge them. And
But it's wine. It's not as if,
I tell people, okay, go back to the late 1960s and ask people what California wine is. It was considered to be garbage. In the mid 70s, that's when California got its break. Now, if you rewind pre-prohibition, you have a totally different scene. But modern, as in post-prohibition, Oregon, California, I mean, these were jokes. These were jokes in the 50s and 60s. And now all the good wine comes from the West Coast, right? This is so recent. But, the change in people's opinion, it was forced on them. It was forced on them by media,
The
by,
industry, I would suppose, in general.
yeah, because the wine was good. And I feel like here in New Hampshire, the industry is fairly new. A lot of the Northeast regions have an old wine industry that people don't know about. For New Hampshire, it is fairly new, but we're talking, decades. And wine, I mean, it takes a while. You're planting grapes that maybe you're not terribly familiar with, and then you're experimenting year after year. You have one shot per year to make something that's the best you can make, and you learn. And so at first, of course, your first few vintages are not going to be your best wines. And so maybe 20, 30 years ago, people tasted New Hampshire wines and said, oh, these are terrible. And maybe they were, but it was the beginning. And now you have people with education who have made wine elsewhere coming here and applying their knowledge. You have people taking really adventurous approaches to what they're doing here instead of following a simple formula, which is what people tend to do at the beginning, right? And you've got an amazing array of wine styles. You've got producers making wines that, I'm sorry, in blind tastings, there's no way people would say, oh, this is from the Northeast. I had a fantastic wine the other day that was a grape called Chamberson. And blind, I would have guessed, I wouldn't have pinpointed the grape, but I would have said it was Italian. And it wasn't. It was Chamberson from, the southeast of New Hampshire. But it's like, you have to be willing to step outside the box and give things a chance and change your own beliefs. And I think that's just very hard for people to accept.
Yeah, but at the end, we're talking wine. It's not as if you're saying that you believe in God or you don't believe in God. In the wine, you have a glass and maybe you like it or you don't. But it's not as if it's like an existential tryout to go and just have a sip of something that is different.
But it takes an open mindset. I think, especially in industries like the wine industry, which wine is an agricultural product, but it's a strange one. It's a luxury agricultural product sometimes. Sometimes it's not. But you have people with, wine has a lot of tradition. Things are done a certain way because they're done that way. And that's how we do it, and that's it. And people who get into the wine industry are not necessarily approaching it from a scientific perspective. They're approaching it in a more romantic way, and they're told a certain thing and they etch that into their brain. And now they're considered an expert and they regurgitate what has been etched into their brain, and they're not comfortable with that potentially being wrong. So they like to scoff at wines like New Hampshire wines and say, well, they're never going to be like California wines. Well, they're not. They're going to be like New Hampshire wines, but they're going to be really, really good. So
Is the younger generation more open?
I'm finding in Vermont, right next door, yes, they're extremely open, but in New Hampshire, no.
Okay.
So
It's
it's
a
really
cultural
interesting.
thing.
It's interesting to work in three different states with very different demographics and see how these wines are embraced or not. So in New Hampshire, I think it's my biggest fight, but I will continue. And Vermont and California are much easier. People are excited to taste wines from, places they don't expect. But New Hampshire, they want their Kendall Jackson Chardonnay. And nothing wrong with Kendall Jackson Chardonnay, but, try something else.
Yes.
So.
What is intriguing is that nowadays we talk a lot about, climate change, the environment, the impact of, shipping and your carbon footprint and stuff like that. Drinking local would seem like a interesting option to have, not to just, ship out things coming from, from the other side of the US or from the other side of the world. So the attitude towards that is kind of intriguing in terms of the perception of the consumer. The second thing that you're working on is also to go back on preconceived ideas of what, bottles of wine should be like, et cetera. Because when you think of it, just not to go too technical, but bottles of wine are kind of heavy. And when you have to ship them from far away, the carbon footprint of the shipping, because it weighs much more, is big. I don't have the exact numbers, but they're important. And one of the things that people are thinking about is either lighter bottles or different packaging. So I know on the Wine Hour, we had a very long conversation on wine in a can. It was kind of a very interesting, polarized, to put it this way. How are people, because this is one of the other work that you're doing, that you're trying to actively promote and think about other types of packaging because of the impact it can have. How has been the reaction to those kind of things that you try to instill in people and get them to accept again about the consumer perception and how they would change their habits?
One quick comment on local consumption. So I do find it interesting that everyone is very proud of their local produce, their local cheese, all of their local products except wine. In some regions, they are very proud of their local wine. If you go to France, for example, you go to, any village and they are on the table, you see the local wine, and if you say, "Oh, but I wanted a Bordeaux," they look at you and they're just like, "You're not in Bordeaux,
But
Go to
not New
Bordeaux and get a
Hampshire,
Bordeaux."
but not in New Hampshire.
Right. Here, I feel like it's very interesting that they don't embrace that when there are even organizations that are built around promoting local. And yet, if you go into, for example, if you go into the local food co-op, they sell wine and they have all of these products, New Hampshire made and all of this, and you go to the wine section and there's no New Hampshire wine. Maybe you'll find one or two, but I would expect a big section of New Hampshire wine saying made in New Hampshire. But the system here is a bit broken, which is why they're not promoting local when it comes to wine and why it's, a big challenge. But that's just an interesting aside. I find the consumer perception of alternative packaging to be a simpler issue than the consumption of local wines. So I think it's interesting to note that the beer industry went through this transition not too long ago. Fine beer was in bottles and cheap beer was in cans. And now you go into a beer shop and you see just, I mean, walls of gorgeous cans with beautiful labels. And it's craft beer and it's every style of beer you can imagine. And everything is, visually appealing. And that's fine now. But when that happened initially, when people started putting higher end beer in cans, there was a pushback from consumers. And, I don't want a can of that. We would, even just 15 years ago, we would have to carry bottles and cans of certain beers because people wouldn't drink it out of the cans. They'd say, "I only drink that out of the bottle." Now it's become a non-issue, I think, in the world of beer. And I mean, maybe there are still some people who are very sensitive to that and will only drink their beer from a certain, container. But in wine, it's very polarizing. And you can see that the people who are really willing to embrace wine in cans tend to be younger. So the millennial generation and beyond, that generation says, sure, wine in cans, why not? And they don't expect it to be a wine cooler or a cheap wine. They have no issue with it being a high-end wine in a can.
They're not going to put the Petrus in
Yeah, cans of Petrus, right? Why not?
the can.
So if you look at a wine bottle, it's an inert vessel and it's meant to hold a wine for a long time and have no quality change in that bottle due to oxygen, basically. That's what it's for, or due to light strike.
But the cork, isn't there any exchange of gas and
Sure.
of air through the cork that helps the aging as well?
Yeah, and if you have a very controlled, very slight introduction of oxygen, then it's fine. Now, eventually, that wine will be over the hill, and that's it. You should have already drank it before. But a wine bottle can hold a wine that's meant for aging for a long time. What kills me is the clear glass wine bottle, because that bottle is not going to protect the wine from light. So therefore, it's not meant to hold the liquid for a really long time, because over time, there will be a certain amount of light that gets in and it's going to spoil your wine. So if you have a dark bottle and you have a wine that's meant for aging, I get it. Put it in a bottle because that's the best container to age wine in. But if you have a light, crisp, aromatic white wine in a clear bottle, you just paid so much extra to ship that because you added a bunch of weight via the glass bottle, but you also added a huge amount to the carbon footprint because glass requires natural gas to make and to recycle. You have to smelt, and smelting has to be done with natural gas as a fuel, and natural gas is not renewable. And of course, you pollute with it. So even if you recycle your bottle, because people say to me, well, but I consume this wine from the bottle, but then I recycle responsibly, so my carbon footprint is reduced. It's not, because when you recycle that bottle, you're going to smelt it again and you're going to use more natural gas. So there's a lot of ways that that bottle is sort of a pain. And for that, I say, well, why wouldn't you put that in a can or a bag and box? Now, there's some issues with bag and box because the liner on the inside, the bag on the inside, is not necessarily biodegradable or recyclable, but people are working on that issue. With cans, there's a couple of issues that most of the time don't come up at all, but you can't add sulfur to a wine and then put it in a can because you'll get a bad reaction that produces hydrogen sulfide, which smells like rotten eggs. But you can work around those issues, and both of those containers can be made with renewable energy sources, have a much smaller carbon footprint. So I feel like the generations that are witnessing the impact of climate change and are realizing that they're going to be dealing with this for the rest of their lives, they're a lot more willing to say, hey, why don't I just drink my wine out of a can? Whereas the older generations are not willing.
So now I imagine they have to drink New Hampshire wine from a can.
You know what? I have not seen New Hampshire wines in cans yet, and I'm a little irritated by that. But first, let me get them drinking New Hampshire wines, and then we'll work on the cans of New Hampshire wines. But I teach a class on alternative packaging, and the class ends with a double blind tasting so that I don't know what I'm tasting either. We use a particular producer called Bridge Lane Wines off of the North Fork of Long Island. And they are doing an interesting project where they're taking a mid-range wine and they're putting it into four different kinds of packaging, the same wine, cans, bottles, bag and box, and kegs. By the way, kegs are the perfect container for wines. But we basically line up a wine, pouring it from each of those four types of packaging. And we do this multiple times with three or four wines. And we taste the wines. And I ask two questions. One, can you tell the difference? Two, if you can, which one is your favorite? And at the end, we tally everything up and we present the results. And the wine that always comes out on top, most people say they can't taste the difference, but the wine that comes out on top is the bag and box. And everyone assumes that they're choosing the bottle because they're very sophisticated and have a sophisticated palate. So, of course, they like the bottle, but they don't. They like the bag and box. So it's a fun class to teach, and it's a little bit mind-blowing for people. I especially like when the older people are in the class.
What is their reactions when they learn that it comes from a bag in a box?
A lot of very loud gasps. And are you sure? Did you mix those up? You know, but and it makes sense because a bag and box is going to protect from oxygen the most. So it's going to keep the wine very pure. Again, this is for wine that should be consumed within a year. It's not for wine that
Yes.
ages, but most wine you consume within a year.
Yes.
So that's, yeah, it works for 90% of wine.
Yes. Getting close to the end of the conversation, and before we go to the people questionnaire, I have one last question.
Sure.
Now that you started your uphill battle on several fronts, one of them, as we said, is to change consumer perception in New Hampshire to try and enjoy the quality of New Hampshire wines. What would you see as your biggest challenge in the coming years, and what would be for you success once you get there, if you can pinpoint that?
So I think the biggest challenge is that's interesting. I was going to say something else, but I just changed my mind. I think the biggest challenge is going to be keeping maintaining perseverance. So the biggest challenge is within me.
Oh.
I think that it's a long-term project, what we're doing in New Hampshire and in Vermont and in California and eventually, you know, who knows where, because it's a principle that we're trying to achieve here. We're trying to everybody thinking, questioning their belief system when it comes to wine. And I mean, when it comes to everything, but we'll start with wine. But questioning their belief system and saying, wait a minute, like, do I know where fine wine comes from in the US? And why shouldn't it come from Ohio, from Pennsylvania, from New Jersey? Why not? Maybe I'll read a little bit of history and see what these regions were doing before Prohibition. And that history is fascinating. So I want to push people to be more curious and to be more willing to try. And that requires a lot of perseverance, a lot of energy on my part, a lot of steamrolling, a lot of ignoring rejection, and it can get exhausting. And so I think that's actually going to be my biggest challenge, but I'm totally up for it. So I'm fine.
I'm sure you are.
But, you know, there are certainly days when I, yeah, there are days when I say, well, what am I doing? Nobody's listening. But then there are days when everybody listens and then I feel
Yes.
great about it. So I have to live for those days. That's going to be the challenge. Success would be when I see these wines in various places in the market, when I go and talk to someone about the wines of any of these regions, and they say, oh, yeah, I had a really good one the other day. When it's not a surprise, and when I no longer hear the one phrase I hate the most, which is, hey, this is actually good. When that phrase changes to, hey, this is good, I will have succeeded. The
Oh, yeah.
actually needs to go away.
Yes. Always remove the adverbs. Yes.
Yeah.
That's what Ernest Hemingway said when he was writing. He never puts adverbs. He says, like, it has to be square and fair. Short sentences, straight to the point. No adverbs.
Yes.
We can wish you only all the best of luck in your marathon. And marathon training is long training, but it's also a lot of rest as well. Both are part of it. So as I said, before finishing, we have the PIVO questionnaire, the usual questions. So it's the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Sure, why not?
Okay. What is your favorite word?
My favorite word. Give me just one second.
Take your time.
I think my favorite word is plethora.
Multitude, a lot of things.
I like how it sounds and I
Yes.
like what it represents. I think it's a good word.
What's your least favorite word?
Moist.
It's the third time that someone tells me moist.
I don't like the way that word sounds. It's just all the wrong sounds.
What's your favorite virtue?
Jeez, these aren't very simple questions. My favorite virtue would be curiosity.
Your favorite quality in a woman?
I think the same thing.
Favorite quality in a man?
I think the same thing again. I think I'm going to change it. I'm going to change it to two things: curiosity and passion. I find that I'm always sad when I meet people who don't have the spark of passion. I think passion gets you through everything. And I mean passion for passion for life, passion for the universe, if that makes any sense. I think with passion, you can make it through absolutely anything. And without it, a lot of things can bring you down.
What wine would you use to describe yourself?
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Let's see. I'm going to use Syrah, A, because it sounds like my name, B, because I really love Syrah, and C, because it always has its personality. You can't remove that from it, no matter how much you want to. Okay. Sometimes it can be overbearing. Sometimes it can be exhausting. But it can also be very elegant and energetic and vibrant. So I think it has a lot of qualities that I would associate with myself, including the negative qualities, because it can, I mean, you can make Syrah and have it not come out so well, and it can have some pretty negative qualities. But I think, all in all, it's a whole package. You've got to take the good with the bad.
Okay, fair enough. There's no beeping. Okay, what's your favorite curse word?
Okay, I'm going to answer this by not answering it. So I do not like curse words for a
Yes.
reason. One, I have a 9-year-old, and I can't, I just can't, because she'll go to school and she'll say this, and I'll get a phone call and I'll be in trouble. And so that. But also, I don't find them to be very creative. So I was talking with my daughter the other day, and there was a
Yes.
boy on her bus, and she said, "Oh, he says F words." And I
Yes.
said, "Really?" And she says, "He yells F words." And okay. And I said, "Well, how does he use them? Is he just saying fuck, or is he using it properly?" And she said, "No, he's just yelling it, and he calls people F words, and he just uses it all the time." And I said, "Well, that's not great. Like, if you want to give someone a good insult and you just pull out swear words, like, that's cheating." And I said to her, "What would insult you more, if someone called you a B word?" And I said B word because she's 9, but she knows what the B word is.
Yeah.
And I said that, or if someone said, "You are a smelly, rotting bag of moldy potatoes." And she said, "Ew." And I said, "Right, that sounds really disgusting, And I said, "This is the problem with swear words. It eliminates our creativity, because if you read really good insults from Shakespeare or something like that, I mean, these are killer insults. And then you can say, 'Oh, look at her, she's a fucking bitch.' And it's like, what does that even mean? It's so easy to just go there.
Yeah, I
So
like
I'm
the
going to say,
potato stuff. We
oh,
can
yeah,
take
she, well, the problem is then
that.
she started calling her friend that, and they were laughing. And I was like, oh, no, please don't go to school and call everyone rotting bags of potatoes, because I'll still get the phone call,
Yes, you still, yes.
But I appreciate language, and I think there's so many amazing ways to express things in potent form. And just saying fucking this, but it's kind of boring. So I hope that answers, although it didn't.
Fair enough. I just I'll take it. I'll take it as it comes. What's your favorite sound or noise?
I think that's a good one too. I have two answers. One is the violin. I love the sound of the violin.
Not
It
someone that is practicing
embodies.
and that is learning afterwards.
You know what? Even that, my daughter, again, I'll use her as an example. She was taking the violin last year. Now she's moved on to the trumpet. So I think
Oh,
I wish the violin was back.
it's a
But I
future Miles Davis,
Yeah, even her,
feminine Miles Davis.
scraping away at the strings and making these, awful noises, I just like the violin a lot.
Okay.
And I think the other thing I like is white noise.
Oh,
It's
fair enough.
very calming.
Yes,
There's too
yes.
much noise in the world. It helps drown it out,
Yes,
and then
yes.
you can focus.
So, what sound or noise do you hate?
I do not like the sound of high heels clicking on a hard floor. I also don't like the sound of cellophane crinkling.
It's very specific. It came out
Yes.
naturally and very
I
quickly.
those sounds make me very angry. So
Okay.
when I have to wear heels because I'm going somewhere where that's like appropriate and what I need to do, I become very irritated by myself walking.
Thank God you don't have any cellophane in your pockets as well. But anyways.
That would be my nightmare.
What plant or animal would you like to be reincarnated in?
Oh, that's a good one. I've thought about this before, but I've come up with different answers. I feel like I would really love to fly. And so sometimes I decide to be like a peregrine falcon because that I could go awfully fast. But then other times I feel like, wouldn't it be great to just be something like an insect where your life is so simple, your goals are right there, and when you're done, you're just done. It's
That's a
just
nice
so
way to look
peaceful.
at it. Yes. I never thought
It's
about it
just so
this way yet.
peaceful. You know, what do? You're born, you try and survive until you eat, you try and survive until you mate, you're done. Like, great. I see the goals, you know. There's no figuring it out.
Yeah, I get that. Yes. Yes. But you wouldn't be able to hear, violin and trumpets
But you
and,
wouldn't care. That's the
yeah,
thing.
true,
It
that
wouldn't
too.
bother
Yeah.
you. You'd be so busy just achieving your little goals and then being done. Now, I could be completely wrong.
No, you won't. It's just
Maybe.
like, yeah.
I mean, if I'm reincarnated as an insect, maybe there's a very rich tapestry of customs and relationships and all of that in the
Probably,
world
yes.
of whatever insect I'm recreated as. So I don't know. I'm making a lot of very ignorant assumptions right
Creativity is always great.
now.
And last question, if
Okay.
heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
See, now I have a lot of things I could say right now, but I don't want to offend anyone of any particular religion.
I'm agnostic.
So,
I don't know about the audience, but in my case, you it's like.
I was raised non-religious. My father was raised Jewish. My mother was raised Catholic. They saw firsthand the bias because when my mother decided to marry my father, there was an uproar and it resulted in some very negative feelings from her family. Those negative feelings resulted in her family having no interest in me or my sister, which was fine because I don't know them, so okay, right? It's no harm done to me, but the idea is very sad. I read the Bible from cover to cover as an exercise just by myself, and I found it fascinating. I also found it very contradictory, and I found that a lot of things people say are in the Bible are not in the Bible. And I also found that it was incredibly graphic. I mean, there's some sections in the Bible that are real page turners, you know, and I thought they let children read this book. So I have an interesting relationship with religion. I do feel that there is a spiritual energy of some kind, but that could just be physics. I don't know. But if I went to this place that we'll call heaven and God was there, I would hope that God would say to me, "Don't worry, I'm not the God from the Bible."
Sarah Trubnik, thank you so much.